We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine from Illinois Public Media, AM 580, 90.9 FM HD2, online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. When it comes to making decisions about our health today, we're simultaneously blessed and cursed with an avalanche of information. So how do we choose? And when we seek help from doctors, how can we take an active part in our care? This afternoon, we take up these questions with Thomas Goetz. We'll take a look at what we can do to make sound health choices and participate in our health care. Thomas Goetz is the author of The Decision Tree, Taking Control of Your Health in the New Era of Personalized Medicine. The book is the result of a realization Thomas Goetz had while working as an editor at Wired Magazine and pursuing a master's degree in public health at the University of California at Berkeley. He wondered if there was a way to combine the promise of technology with the rigor of public health to help people make better choices about their health. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Thomas Goetz is the executive editor of Wired Magazine. He's also a contributor to the New York Times Magazine, and he earned that degree in public health at Berkeley. The Decision Tree, Taking Control of Your Health in the New Era of Personalized Medicine, is published by Rodale, and you can visit Thomas Goetz online at thedecisiontree.com. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Thomas Goetz, how are you? Good to talk with you.
Good. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. So what led you to pursue a degree in public health?
Well, I was the black sheep of my family, if you will. I come from a family of healthcare providers, doctors and nurses, and I resisted for as long as I could as a journalist, but finally I broke down and decided to learn a bit more about healthcare.
Yeah, what a great thing to put together, journalism and public health. I would think that would serve you very well in this day and age.
Yeah, well, it's actually been fascinating because the approach that public health takes is very similar to the approach that we take at Wired Magazine, which is to look for where are the levers, where can you push levers to get kind of profound change. And that's really kind of what we look for at Wired. We look for where profound change is kind of happening and about to happen. And that's been the kind of ideas of public health for a long time. Going back to things like, you know, sanitation and vaccines, those are very simple technologies that have profound ramifications. So what I thought was, is there something in this information technology age where we can get some of these principles of public health to engage people in their health and equally affect profound change.
Yeah. Do you use decision trees at Wired Magazine?
Well, we love our charts and graphs and infographics, that's for sure. So, yeah, we use them all the time.
Yeah. What is a decision tree?
Well, a decision tree is in a complicated sense, it's an algorithm, right? It's a way to make calculations based on probabilities and statistics to kind of arrive at a optimal outcome. In a simple way, it's a flowchart. It's just a way of putting information in a sequence so that you kind of know where you're headed and know where you want to end up. And it's more the latter, more the second aspect that I'm drawing on in the book. It's to me, it's a device or a kind of frame of reference that people could use to think about what choices am I making for my healthcare or for my health that I could choose differently, or I could choose another course and actually have better health. And then how do I make that decision? What information do I need at that point? And my hope is that that's a way of engaging in our health that people will find useful and serve them to have better health in the end.
Yeah, so it's a list of sort of to put this together for our radio audience to describe it, it's on one side of the paper you put pluses and the other side you put minuses, and then you think of, okay, it's sort of, well, plan A is not going to work or didn't work, so let's go to plan B, which gets us to another point. Is that pretty good?
Yeah, I mean, actually, so what you describe is very much like what Ben Franklin actually described, 200 years ago. He suggested a list of pros and cons that people kind of go through this what he called moral arithmetic. My hope is that, you know, we get so much health information. We're inundated with health research and recommendations and, sometimes contradictory research, that it's very difficult for the individual to kind of know where they stand and what they should do with all that information. And where we stand right now is at the advent of a moment when we can actually start to engage, turn that information and engage our own personal circumstances, our own data and situation, and combine our specific information with that more general information and come up with a course of action. And that's what I think of as a decision tree.
Okay. And that course of action hopefully would, thanks to the decision tree, would lead us to good decisions, better decisions, sound decisions.
Yes. This is where I always insist and make clear that there's no such thing as a perfect decision, right? Especially when it comes to our health, things are always going to happen that we didn't prepare for and that we don't expect and probably that we don't want. I mean, ultimately, the secret of life is that we all end up dead, in a sense. So, but the opportunity is to really take advantage of the role that we have and the role that we play that we often overlook. You know, we make all these little decisions every day. What do we eat? How much exercise are we going to get? Do I really want to kind of follow up my doctor's recommendations, or do I want to kind of ignore it, put it on the back burner? Those little decisions add up to be our health. And we can be making much better decisions and more informed decisions. And that's what I'm trying to engage people in, because what I was really happy to turn up in my research was that when people take an active and engaged role in their health, they tend to have better outcomes. So when we pay attention to our health, we tend to have better health. And the research that demonstrates that, I think, is a really profound catalyst for, and it's a profound argument for, getting people more involved and giving them the tools to get more involved.
Hmm. At the beginning of the decision tree, you set out three rules. Maybe we can talk about each one of these.
Sure.
Beginning with early is better than late.
Right. Well, so that is the early detection and prevention have been the basic recipe of preventive medicine and public health for 50, 60 years. So we start to know what our risks for disease are rather than kind of waiting for disease. Now the really deflecting that or using that as a full-fledged strategy for the way we live life, I think a lot of us don't do yet. You know, we take certain actions, we are mindful of a few certain risks that we may have, but we don't really think of kind of our whole portfolio of risks that we might be engaging in not just a kind of short-term horizon, but a medium-term or a long-term horizon. You know, when we think about what our parents died of or what our grandparents died of, those are opportunities for us to kind of plan the course of our own lives and to use their information and their lives as building blocks for our own lives. So I think that kind of engagement with prevention, really, we can take much further than we do now.
Yeah. And early is better than late. Also, I think we could also say now is better than next month.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I think there's a, we all have, and I include myself in this, we all have the tendency to postpone. We all have the tendency to say that, you know, we'll exercise tomorrow, not today.
Yeah.
And as I say, those are the little decisions that actually, tomorrow we might actually be sick. And that's that's what I'm trying to suggest is that this isn't just a matter of warding off illness. This is a matter of holding on to and improving our health, and that really is what I think is something we need to get start thinking about and really think of as a positive thing. I mean, that really too much of our health information is negative and kind of you know, we dread thinking about our health sometimes because we are waiting for something to go wrong. And I think if we're being more more proactive with our health, we actually can turn our health into something that we're engaged with, we feel good about, we feel happy about.
Okay. Rule number two: let the data do the work.
Right. So this is you know, we live in a statistical data-driven age, and there are algorithms and formulas all over the place. The it seems kind of counterintuitive, but data has been actually slow to make inroads in medicine. You know, about 20 years ago, there was the idea of evidence-based medicine, the idea that most medical judgments should be made based on specific evidence and research. That has made great inroads, but it still is not the kind of default or the norm in medicine. Too often, we rely on kind of our doctors and our physicians to kind of make their own gut decisions when there's a lot of work that data can use. You know, there's a lot of research that we can draw on that guides us in paths and helps us make decisions and helps our physicians make decisions as well. And part of that turn to data, I think, is all the data that kind of that we are creating that we're not really capturing. You know, when you think about some of the research that I did, for instance, this they did this great study at the Brown University, this study called the National Weight Control Registry. And what they did is they looked at the number of people, 5,000 people, who have successfully lost weight and kept it off. And it turns out that one of the things that people do, in addition to kind of changing their diet and getting more exercise, but one of the things that's associated with sustained successful weight loss is simply stepping on a scale every day. And a lot of people, more than 50% of the people in this registry, stepped on a scale more than once a day. So it's that kind of harnessing of data and using our own information as a feedback loop to really help us engage in active decision making that improves our health.
Okay. And the final rule, openness is a powerful thing.
Right. So here is the idea of groups and collaboration. So you've heard a lot about kind of the power of groups and maybe social networks in terms of Facebook and Twitter and some of the stuff that's happening online. Well, it turns out that the power of social networks works to our health as well. When you think about something as kind of traditional as Weight Watchers, one of the reasons that Weight Watchers works, research has shown, is because they form these really tight, powerful groups. They call it the magic of the meeting in Weight Watchers. And what you're doing is it goes in hand with the feedback loop that I just described. When you are able to use your data and your kind of place and compare it with other people and build your data together with other people's data and information and perspective, you get real insight. And that's the power of collaborative decision making and collaborative information in healthcare, is that we get insights and we can kind of avoid being adrift and on our own, and we can actually gain a lot of insight and guidance from other people's experience.
Yeah. I was talking with someone yesterday on the telephone, and he needs to lose some weight, and he needs to make better choices about what he's eating, and it's really tough. He said, you know, I think if I was married, it would be better. It would be easier. And I hung up the phone, and I had been reading your book, and I thought, he should join Weight Watchers.
Yeah, well, so I was surprised at how effective Weight Watchers is. You know, I like probably a lot of your listeners, have always heard about Weight Watchers and always thought it was kind of a gimmicky program. But it turns out that they have these two principles really well established. They are really good about feedback, and they're really good about groups. And those things have made Weight Watchers one of the few successful, and research shows one of the few successful dieting programs out there. What we have right now is the opportunity to use those same principles, feedback and groups, and not necessarily have to sign up with a program like Weight Watchers. We can access these two principles on the internet with you know, colleagues and communities that exist online. So that's to me is quite auspicious.
Yeah. Or I guess this is also why they say if you have a buddy to exercise with, that your chances of success are better.
Yeah, exactly. And there's some great research that comes out of the Framingham Heart Study in Framingham, Massachusetts, where they have seen that not only are groups powerful for transmitting good health messages like quitting smoking, but groups are actually, ironically, somewhat good at transmitting negative information. So you see things like obesity spreading through social networks. So the group can be a powerful driver towards behavior, both good and bad. And we need to be aware of the influence that we're having on our friends and family members, both for good and bad when it comes to our health.
Hmm. Also, thinking of Weight Watchers and thinking of data at the same time, they have a points system. That's a powerful tool as well, is it not?
Yeah. So they came up with this nifty strategy in the late 90s that they call the point system. And this is a patented formula that uses the nutrition information label and converts the calories and fat and carbs content into a number of points. And so when you join Weight Watchers, based on your goal body weight and your current body weight and some other metrics, it gives you a number of points that you can consume per day. And the trick is you're tracking your points. You're constantly tracking your consumption of points. And it's a simple feedback loop. What it's having you do is be aware of what you're eating and what you're consuming and the choices that you're making on an ongoing basis. And having that kind of self-monitoring, having that engaging people in their information and their data and where they stand is a really effective way at getting people to change their behavior.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is a journalist who holds a master's degree in public health. His name is Thomas Goetz. He is the author of The Decision Tree, Taking Control of Your Health in the New Era of Personalized Medicine. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Email is will-talk@illinois.edu. Generally speaking, we know what we should be doing and what we shouldn't be doing. And you write about this problem, the paradox of behavior change. I had never heard it called that before. What insights can you share with us about the paradox of behavior change?
Well, so everybody, this is kind of the great frustration for many people in the public health community. The actual things that we should be doing for our health in terms of simple behaviors are pretty well known, right? I mean, everybody pretty much knows that we should be eating better. We should be watching our calories. We shouldn't eat too much meat and so forth. And everybody pretty much knows that they should be getting regular exercise. We shouldn't be smoking. We shouldn't be consuming too much alcohol, things like that. The basic principles of healthy behavior are widely known and available. The problem is not enough of us do those things. In fact, when you put together the four basic behaviors, maintain a healthy body weight, don't smoke, eat regular fruits and vegetables, and eat healthy, balanced diet, those four behaviors, only 3% of Americans manage to do all four of those consistently. And that's a kind of staggering realization that we don't do what we're supposed to do, even though we know we should. And so the challenge is well, what are the tricks? What do we know? What have we learned about people who are succeeding in getting over that paradox and are succeeding in actually changing their behavior for the better? And it goes back to these ideas of feedback and groups. So it's not magic, but they work pretty well. They're two of the things that have been known to be effective. Things like writing down your food that as you eat it, food diaries, that works pretty well. The challenge has always been that is an extra behavior, right? It takes more work, actually, to write everything down than it does just to change your diet. You also have to start writing everything down every day. So that's been a very kind of well-known principle, but difficult to do in practice.
Let's take I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say the opportunity we have now is that there are all these new tools and information technologies that, that actually make it easier to log that information and make it less onerous for individuals. So I think that's where we are now, is that, that people are going to be finding new tools and new ways of working on these principles and getting them to work on their behalf.
Okay. Let's take a call. We have a listener waiting for us in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Hey, hello. How are you?
Fine. And you?
Good. Thank you. Hey, I'm calling. I'm Sandra Otten. I've actually been on your program before.
Oh, hi, Sandra.
Hi. How are you?
I'm fine.
Good. Well, I have, you know, the Reasonable Diet Group.
Right.
I do. I'm a diet and wellness coach. And so I wanted to just get some information. I absolutely agree with you that, you know, I can't wait to read your book. But the data and the group feedback being so important, and the group support being so important, and the accountability being so important in that way. I do groups both on the phone and in person, and I wonder, it just, do you have any feedback on that, just whether which is more effective in analysis? I have my own opinion about it, my own, you know, information, but I just wondered if there is any official study.
Any the research? Well, I don't really know of any. I'm sure the research has been done, but I don't, off the top of my head, I don't have research that compares the two. I guess I would probably say that in person works better, but the magic of the phone is it's easier, right? So you can actually ping people more often, and you have more opportunity for broader engagement. And that, you know, the phone it's a very good example, actually, because the phone is a very simple technology, right? So the phone gives us what we call in the technology world some scale. So it lets us reach more people more easily. And that, to me, is really what's so exciting about something like the internet, is that, and using these principles with new tools online, is that you can even cast a wider net and a broader net. Weight Watchers, for instance, just to go back to them, Weight Watchers has found that when people do their program, which is in person, combined with using their website, they have the people who do both have 50% higher effectiveness for their programs.
Right.
So when you combine them, you get even better results.
Right. Well, that's probably in large part because of the writing down factor, because when you're doing it online, you're often recording your food, which makes you more, you know, conscious of what you're eating and more motivated to eat better, that little factor. But I agree. A lot of my clients, even they do the phone groups with me or the in-person groups, but they also do an online component, either with Weight Watchers or Calorie King, or there's free ones like Spark People and things like that are good tools also. But I find that people do actually do that groups on the phone are just as effective, because I think people can focus a little bit easier, and it just, like you said, it's convenient
yeah,
at that time.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, and right. I think the, you know, you're, it's a trade-off, right? So you're probably, my gut would say, you get a higher success rate when people come to a in-person meeting, but you get more people when you do it on phone. So you're actually reaching more people, and versus kind of a slightly reduced effectiveness for phone, where people can kind of zone out or disengage a little bit. But still, I think the, you know, the idea of combining these tools and technologies is really the most promising route, probably.
And Sandra, I have a question for you. In terms of, we talked about building in a new behavior. What's your experience with how long it takes for something new to attach, so to speak?
That's interesting, because it's so funny when people say 21 days or anything like that, you know, because it's, you can have lost weight and maintained it for a long period of time and still have a relapse type of thing, you know, that causes you. Anyway, I've been studying a lot about neuroplasticity the last year or so, and just one of the things that you really realize when you read all about neuroplasticity is that the brain can change. You really can reprogram, but it takes so much longer than people believe that it does, that your old pathways are still there. They're so susceptible to going back down that old pathway so easily. And so I literally think it takes years of reinforcement and that's why the outside motivation is so important. So you stay, you know, mindful that you could go down that old road so easily and stay there if you don't have some way that you're checking in regularly, which I think is what you're saying with the groups. You have that place where you're really getting checked in, right?
Right. And when you talk about brain plasticity, you know, this is where things like exercise actually play such an important role too, because you know, research has shown that exercise is really good at engaging some of that plasticity and reprogramming the brain. Mm-hmm. So it's more than just diet. When you combine diet with exercise, you're actually engaging your brain in new ways that I think can be an even more powerful catalyst towards sustained change.
I try to tell people that they literally, you have to just start rethinking that you actually have to be on a diet forever. There's not it starts and it stops. You have to get up every morning and think, how am I going to make the changes I want to make in my life today? How am I going to have a decent diet? Because it doesn't happen by accident. It never happens by accident. You have to think of it even years later. Normal people think of it, and people who don't want to think of it, you know, they'd say, oh, I'm done dieting. I don't ever want to do that again. I don't have to go down that path. I'm like, well, get with the real world, because that's what we have to do. We have to think, how are we going to have a healthy diet? Because in this society, it's not going to happen by accident.
Right. No, the way I've been talking about it is, you know, we have our culture has done a great job at indulging our worst impulses. We have created all sorts of institutions and activities that basically let us eat food that makes us more overweight and obese, and lets us kind of sit and kind of get passive entertainment. So what we need to do, as you say, we need to be constantly making conscious choices that work against that. And that takes work and that takes effort, but it is rewarding, and we do get positive feedback when we're able to break away and kind of chart our own course.
I want to thank Sandra for her call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Thomas Goetz, author of The Decision Tree, Taking Control of Your Health in the New Era of Personalized Medicine. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. If you'd like to join us, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. By email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, we've spent quite a bit of time here on early is better than late. Let's talk about data. What kind of data are you talking about? And maybe you would talk with us here about genetic tests. This is relatively new to us. What are your thoughts about genetic tests?
Well, so it's interesting. There's a lot of enthusiasm out there now and growing enthusiasm for genetic testing. And a lot of it, I think, is quite good. You know, we've in the last 15, 20 years, they've rooted out all sorts of diseases that have genetic origin. And there are all sorts of tests that we take, and that, you know, when you're an expectant mother, there are all sorts of genetic tests that we take of our babies that are you know, preborn, and then newborns have all sorts of genetic tests. And that, you know, we do oftentimes without thinking. And then there's new kinds of genetic testing that are being offered that are kind of fall under the rubric of what's called personal genomics. So these are kind of tests that we can take to see if we have predispositions, genetic risks for disease later in life. So these are a lot of the diseases that, you know, not the rare genetic tests or not rare genetic diseases. Most of the diseases that are caused entirely by genetics are thankfully very rare. Most of the diseases that actually kill us, heart disease, stroke, diabetes, cancer, those have some genetic component, but not altogether a genetic component. Mm-hmm. There's a large environmental component to them. So the trick is to use these kind of the new research that's coming out of genetic sciences and to help it inform our decisions, but it doesn't become entirely predictive. I mean, it's a very kind of a misapprehension that a lot of us have about genetics, is that we think they'll find a gene for heart disease or a gene for diabetes or something like that. And by and large, that isn't the way it's going to work. What we're going to find out is that there are genes that increase our risk, and that's one kind of finger on the scale. But there are all sorts of other fingers on the scale that come from our other choices in life. So the traditional things that we think about with our health, the same things, the diet and exercise stuff. So it's important to take advantage of genetics when it offers us more information, better information, more data. but it's not going to ever kind of be this. I don't think it's going to be a complete revelation on kind of the crystal ball that people may have thought it would be a few years ago.
Yeah, environment is huge. Maybe you'd tell us quickly, in brief, Eddie Curry's story.
Right. So Eddie Curry, it's a really neat example. He's a professional basketball player. He was playing for the Chicago Bulls, and a few years ago he was at a game warming up, and he had his heart was beating really fast, and they were worried that he had a condition called HCM. It's basically a genetic condition where you have a weak heart, and the reason they were especially afraid is that two previous basketball players had HCM and died on the court. So they were, the Chicago Bulls were worried that Eddie Curry had the risk for this disease and was, his life was in danger. So they asked him to get a genetic test. Well, at the time, there was no law that protected individuals from their employees demanding that they do something based on their genetics. So Eddie Curry had a choice. He could take the test, and if he came up negative for a risk for HCM, then he would stay with the Bulls. Or if he failed the test, then he would have to give up his Bulls contract, and they offered him a kind of yearly stipend, but he'd have to give up basketball. What Eddie Curry decided to do actually was to go a third way. He decided to not take the test, not find out if he had a genetic risk for HCM, but he did find a new team, the New York Knicks, that was willing to offer him a contract. So Eddie Curry was able to kind of navigate his way around this question mark of whether or not he had a genetic risk for HCM, and basically putting his life and his basketball career in danger. What happened, though, the irony of the situation was, what became his undoing was plain old behavior. He was eating too much. He was overweight. It was not the kind of intriguing futuristic science of genetics that was Eddie Curry's problem. It was the kind of mundane science of nutrition. And he was eating so much that he was having huge health problems. And he was sent to a fat camp last summer by the Knicks in the hope of bringing him back into shape and playable shape. And I think this year, last I checked in on him, he has not been getting a lot of playing time, and he's not looking like he was going to have the promising career he once thought he had.
Mm. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Yeah, the decision tree is very interesting. What about applied to making a decision in terms of medical? You know, in other words, you have some particular problem. You did give it in terms of the heart, that kind of thing. But and is there any, you know, how do you weight? You know, you get data and certain procedures, in terms of solving a particular problem. And then it's sometimes what happens, too. You say, well, a lot of stuff is available today. Also, in terms of the source, you know, you got that problem, too.
Yeah.
In my case, I look in terms of if I have a particular thing that I'm interested in. You know, I do a search, but, you know, a lot of it is, done by universities, things of that nature. And you sort of weigh the evidence. But, you know, the web can be sort of a problem sometimes in terms of information. How is that issue? Also, I'm very much into alternative medicine, and sometimes in terms of alternative medicine, there is some evidence. You know, echinacea, there has actually been studies. I find it very powerful in terms of the flu season and things of that nature.
Right.
But it also depends on the quality of the product. I mean, there's a lot of echinacea that you really shouldn't, you'd be better off taking nothing, you know, that kind of thing. But
right. So that you raise a very good point. So a lot of what we've been talking about so far is in terms of prevention and preventive behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the most pressing decisions that we face in terms of our healthcare are when we do have a condition and we need to choose between treatments, sometimes involving, you know, serious things like surgery and drugs that have side effects. And that is a very important kind of opportunity for better decision making, but it's also a very fraught one. It's one that we often, a lot of us tend to, you know, say, well, it's getting really complicated, and they kind of turn over the decision making to their doctors. Well, what I was able to find out was that when actually people have a role in that kind of decision making among treatments, when people are working with their physicians on those decisions, they tend to have better outcomes. So when we have the entree, when we're given a role in our health and our health decisions, even at that stage when things are really serious, we're better served by doing the work and participating. But as you say, you know, where do we get the information? Right now, the information is coming at us from all over the place. The internet is a potpourri of rumor and conjecture. So we need to be very careful about what we decide to be, you know, what we decide to heed. And so one thing that I was really happy about in writing the book was there's a whole new movement coming out of a lot of interesting universities and programs where they're developing new decision tools and new tools that help us basically integrate our personal information with the specific research that's been done on various treatments. So, for instance, if you have a risk of heart disease, there are calculators, online calculators, that will help you get to specific behaviors and specific treatments that can help you improve your chance of successfully kind of warding off the worst effects of heart disease. So those are they're called Framingham risk calculators, and they're wonderful tools. There are other tools out there that are available for people that are considering various cancer treatments. There are decision tools for people who are facing statins and having to choose among statins for treating high cholesterol. They aren't exhaustive yet. There isn't a complete kind of armada of these decision tools out there, but there are more all the time. There's a great website called lifemath.net. That's LIFEMATH.NET, lifemath.net. And it has a lot of these kind of personal calculators that help people with a specific problem and looking at some serious decisions that help them find their way through those decisions. And the more we're able to kind of find those tools and use them with our doctor's advice, the better our outcomes will be.
Does the listener want to follow up? No, I think the listener is gone. Let's take another call. Another caller in Champaign, line 2. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. In a way, this is a follow-up to the previous call. While I was waiting on the phone, the guest's answers came close to what I was going to ask about all, but not exactly. Now, from the title of the book, I sort of expected that what you were going to talk about was, in fact, what many years ago the computer scientists called an expert system. I don't know whether that mm-hmm. is still in use or not, which would allow someone, the way I was visualizing it, when you start with a problem, and maybe your first question is, well, do I need to go to the doctor? That you could sit mm-hmm. down at the computer and bring up this program, and it would say, what's your problem? And you'd say, well, I've got this bad headache I've had all afternoon. And it would start asking you questions. And on the basis of your questions, it would ask you more questions. And eventually it would give you some sort of advice about, well, you should see the doctor, or you will do fine just taking some aspirin or something like that. And that you could start out with, I'm overweight, and what should I do, and so forth. And that you could do an awful lot of the back and forth. It wouldn't be a natural language, probably. It'd be by multiple choices of various kinds. But it would allow something like this would embody online all the really basic stuff that we know that's almost impossible even for a doctor to know. And it would make it available for this kind of interactive decision-making that I think you're basically talking about.
Yeah. Well, you are right in concept. That is exactly the ideal platonic version of what I'm talking about is as you described, something where you could just simply kind of enter a question or a kind of concern into a decision engine, and it would lead you through and get you to a specific course of action. In fact, on my website, there's a little widget that we put up there to kind of give a gesture at some of this stuff that it leads through people through a few questions, and that's at the website, thedecisiontree.com. The trick is that creating one of those that is extensive and exhaustive for all kind of the whole encyclopedia of people's health concerns, that is beyond the scope of what anybody has accomplished so far. So the ideal version of that doesn't exist. So what I try to put across in the book is how do people create and assemble that information on their own. So there are various services out there for various conditions that kind of bite off a little chunk of that here or there, but there's not right now a one-stop shop. I hope there will be. I hope, and I've talked to a few people at different companies who have kind of grasped the larger potential of this idea as you have, as the listener has. So maybe we'll start something in the next few years. We will start to have those tools, those overall tools.
Listener, want to follow up? I think the listener is gone. Let's take
I sold him. Yeah. I sold him on.
TheDecisionTree.com. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Indianapolis on line 4. Hi.
Hi. I tuned in a little bit late. It looked like earlier you were having a weight loss discussion. And so I'm not sure if this is actually on topic completely or not, but on the subject of weight loss, there's constantly advice in media of all forms about how making a very simple change in your life, walking an extra 20 minutes, or, you know, just eating, you know, not putting butter on your roll will, over the course of a year, you know, result in a weight loss of, you know, 5, 10, 15, whatever pounds. And I've never found that to be true. In fact, just counting calories, unless you're doing it rigidly, has never been very successful for me. I've actually managed to lose probably 60 pounds over the past 4 years, but it was in a couple of big spurts of being absolutely rigid, following a nutritionist's advice, a doctor saying, hey, you need to lose some weight, without really any, you know, great knowledge about how to do it, and only through being completely, absolutely rigid to get to a lower weight. I mean, once you get to a lower weight, you can sort of maintain it by making compromises with people. But the advice in the media has nothing to do with my experience about weight loss has been, and I don't know if you're covering that or not, but if you are, it'd be an interesting topic to hear discussed a little bit.
It's a very, I mean, your experience, I think, provides a great example of what I try to get across in the book, discussing relevance. So the way we get information right now, the way too much health information is given, is in this kind of generic overall sense, and we're basically, the information is put out there, and we're somehow expected to filter our way through it and find the bits and pieces that will work for us. Really what the healthcare system needs to do is to go a step further and to find a way to engage specific information with specific people, and that's what relevant information is. So we need to go further and create ways to match up the data with people's individual circumstances the way you were able to do. Your experience brings another thing to mind, which is this idea of a health crisis or a health scare that people have. You know, you said that your doctor had to recommend that you lose weight. Now, you probably knew you needed to lose weight in the back of your mind before then, but it took your doctor to really tell you that, it sounds like, until you actually took action. And I think this idea of a health scare is very interesting, and I think I discussed it in a book, and kind of how people are looking at maybe trying to create new ways of diagnosing risk that wake people up before they are at a situation where they need to go to a doctor and the doctor is saying, look, you've got a big problem, you've got to do something about this. How do we get that action? How do we trigger action in people before they've gone all the way into a kind of course of a disease? And nobody has solved that yet, but I think it's a very interesting problem and a very interesting opportunity that lies out there.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. What's on the horizon for knowing that something is brewing within us, that we've got something that is going to cause us a real big problem down the line, and we want to get it early? Maybe you'd talk just a moment or two about the Canary Foundation.
Right. So that's a great example of kind of how do we use these techniques to get better diagnosis. So what the Canary Foundation is trying to do is to create new tools for screening for cancer. So a lot of the research that's out there, in fact, most of the research that we spend on cancer is looking at cures, is looking at treatments. So you're waiting for the disease to get diagnosed, and then we're trying to create new drugs and new treatments that will somehow vanquish the tumor, kill the disease, basically. The Canary Foundation is taking the opposite approach. They're trying to find ways to spot the disease really, really early so that it's a much simpler procedure, so that we don't need to use this kind of cocktail of drugs and treatments, that we can basically just do a simple surgery. The challenge is, what are the clues? What are the kind of little, what do they call, biomarkers that we need to find that will give us a early sign of the disease, of a cancer? And so they've brought together some of the best researchers in the world on this problem, and they're really taking a very innovative approach towards solving the question of finding cancers early, which is a hard problem, so that the treating them is easier and simpler.
Yeah, really interesting. So all the way through, from thinking about our risks to diagnosis and treatment, decision trees can really help us out.
I hope so. I mean, my hope is that, you know, this is it's a way of giving people a sense of control. I mean, mm-hmm. That's really what it boils down to. When people have a sense of